Good afternoon to this meeting of the Senate Resources Committee. We come to order at 5:13 p.m. Today is Wednesday, March 4th. We're in Butcherbitch Room 205. The delay was due to another legislative meeting that we were all required to attend. So here we are, and let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. With us today is Senator Coghill, Senator Bishop, Senator Rivak, and Senator Keel. I am Senator Machicki. Due to our late start, we will not be hearing Senate Bill 130 or Senate Bill 189. I apologize to the public for not having the time for those bills today. On our agenda today, however, we have a presentation by the Alaska Outdoor Alliance. And first up, we have Lee Hart, Alaska Outdoor Alliance, for a lead-off overview. And with her is Don Stryker, Acting Regional Director in the National Park Service. So it is all yours. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator Machicki, and to the rest of the committee. Thank you for inviting us to give you an update on the outdoor recreation sector in Alaska. Our delegation brings you, we were here last year, some of you may recall. We actually have some of the same players, but we have different messages. In one case we do. We have the same message. But our delegation brings you updated information and new perspectives around the original premise of strengthening our economy, stimulating rural economic development, and improving daily life through outdoor recreation, and our belief that that should be a priority. After my brief opening comments about the state of the industry, you'll have a chance to hear from members of our delegation about why outdoor recreation matters and what you can do to support it. The numbers speak for themselves. As you can see on this slide, it's sort of a compilation of greatest hits of state data from the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development and the United States Bureau of Economic Analysis. So in March of last year, CED released an outdoor industry study that showed that our industry contributes $3.2 billion in spending in Alaska, and that 81% of Alaskans participate in outdoor recreation, compared to 48% as the national average, and other cool facts. The BEA in this fall released state-level data showing that the gross domestic product for the state from outdoor recreation totals 4.2%, which makes us the seventh largest outdoor recreation economy of the United States. I think we can do better. Another important fact I want to point to is an arrow. I want to explain a little bit about the arrow that's the second little graphic down on the right side there, and point out to you that even while the state's economy was declining, between 2012 and 2017, state GDP lost 9%, while the outdoor recreation sector gained 19%. Those figures are from the federal government. And they use whatever that methodology is that's standard for them. So I think that that's an interesting data point for you. Shows we're a bit recession-proof and we can weather various storms. We are a big tent representing summer and winter, motorized and non-motorized interests, hunters, anglers, and wildlife watchers, makers and sellers, stewards, and allies in healthcare and education. And we are united to work to change the conversation and have a seat at the table when we're talking about natural resource development in this state. And when we talk about investing in sectors that can lead the nation, there is no reason we shouldn't be number one. And when we talk about one of the things that we need to do that is better apples-to-apples data about our sector. We continue to look at opportunities for research. We talk to people in ICER and CED about where we can, what our next research product should be, so that we not only inform you all better and give you data to make better decisions, but can establish baseline data where we can measure against in future years. Investing in our sector should be a no-brainer. It's an economic powerhouse that has proven capacity to deliver jobs, attract visitors who bring cash into our businesses and communities, and improve health and educational outcomes for our people. This slide has a variety of logos from people who have been interested in what we're doing and who have been engaged with us in our conferences and in partnerships to again, strengthen this sector. So we've attracted key players in the tourism industry, local, state, and federal land managers, like the fella talking, sitting next to me, industry partners, universities, businesses, enthusiast groups, conservation-minded organizations, and others. Ours is an industry rooted in passion for our sports, our favorite places, and the gateway communities that are the base camps for adventure. We are hikers, bikers, skiers, snow machine rippers, guides, outfitters, educators, healthcare workers, builders, filmmakers, career, public land professionals, planners, and others who connect with this industry consciously and not because we couldn't figure out something else to do. It puts roofs over our heads, it sends our kids to school, and keeps our dollars and our manpower making our communication, our community stronger and better. And for those of us lucky enough to work in this sector, it gives us an excellent work-life balance. So with that, I'd like to turn over the mic to those in our delegation to share with you their perspectives and, again, build the case for why it makes good sense to invest in outdoor recreation.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you very much for your time. Just to avoid confusion, I'll remind you I'm Don Stryker. Some of you I met last year when I was down here answering questions about the state's South Denali proposal. I'm the superintendent of the National Park Denali, but I was advocating for my state partners. Frankly, I'm looking for a reason to come down once a year and make sure that you know that I'm available and I'm always ready to partner with you in any of the efforts that you have underway. Again, thank you for your service. I think that you probably get a lot of people making pitches to you, and you probably don't get thanked enough. But from where I sit, I certainly thank you for your service. I watched a little bit of the mandatory presentation that you just attended, and a lot of people put a lot of things on your backs, and I just appreciate you being here and listening to us. I have some slides in your deck. I won't bore you by repeating them. The national park system in Alaska is pretty big business for the state of Alaska. We have 15 parks representing about 3 million visits a year. That represents about $2 billion industry throughout the state of Alaska. I think more importantly, though, the parks that we have in our Alaskan quiver represent many of the tourism magnets for the state as a whole. And you see that particularly in Glacier Bay and in Denali with the Denali Park Road. Relatively recently, we had some misleading press about the Denali Park Road and the fact that it may be closed for part of the year. That was in part a reaction to the fact that we're seeing wetter summers. And so for the last two summers, we'd seen certain time periods when we were getting some washout along the road. And we were trying to notify the public that we were preparing in the eventuality that that happened again, and that if that happened, what we would do is we would close at the point of failure, but we would be open, trying to emphasize the we will be open for a good experience regardless of whether there needs to be a very short-term temporary closure. But in the sort of the heat of the moment and the press capitalizing on that and painting a picture that Denali may be closed, it really galvanized folks all throughout the state, as my phone was ringing off the hook, and drove home the relative importance of that one road in one spot to the overall economics throughout Alaska and the ripple effect that that has and the relative importance that that asset is, and as a result, the importance of the Park Service sort of recognizing our responsibility on behalf of our great state. To make sure that we keep those jobs open and those that visit open. I was really impressed, though, that that event galvanized us to work together. You know, frankly, this is similar to when I walked into a park that I managed in West Virginia, and I walked in on a Saturday, and there was a fellow who must have seen my picture in the paper. I hadn't even started work. I wasn't wearing anything identifiable as Park Service. And this old-timer came up to me in the Walmart and started giving me a lot of grief because allegedly we were trading wild turkeys for rattlesnakes. And when I followed up on that, that was rooted in the fact that the Park Service had a really bad relationship with our neighbors in that part of southern West Virginia. And so I set out about to, you know, how do you fix this situation? Shouldn't be a hard thing to do if we can just focus on some common areas of interest. And just to fast forward, I worked closely with the governor and the delegation, and we did some neat things, like we took the state's 876-foot-high bridge that the Park Service owned the two access points and worked hand in glove and came up with a bridge walk where now you can put a harness on and you can clip in and you can walk across that bridge above the New River Gorge River. Really put that part of West Virginia on a map and enabled us to make a pitch to the Boy Scouts of America when they were looking for a new permanent jamboree site to pitch an area immediately adjacent to New River Gorge National River, which we did. We were successful. $500 million of private investment later. That part of southern West Virginia is really seeing the rewards of that collaboration. And what I'm desperate to try to do is to amplify or to help figure out how can we in Alaska capitalize on that effort. I'm frustrated a little bit by the fact that, and I understand where it comes from, Anilka, I understand there's a long history of us not necessarily being good neighbors. But for the Park Service to be considered the bullseye of federal overreach instead of the IRS or the EPA, you know, I'd just like to say in off years, don't think of us and don't think of me that way. Instead, let's focus on the fact that we all share in a lot more commonality, especially when we're talking about these awesome resources that we have at our disposal. And all it's really going to take is to figure out how to get these collective smart minds to work together to figure out where we overlap. And once we put that agenda together with our delegation, we'll be steamrolling through. If there's another infrastructure bill, if there's a Restore Act, the new transportation bill, all of these tools in our toolbox when we figure out what that area of overlap is going to look like. And I'm just here to say, you know, I'm Park Service, Service is our last name. Literally, I am at your disposal and looking actively for opportunities how we can help advance your agenda and truly be good neighbors. So the rest of the certified smart people on topic are behind me. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. And I suppose what you're saying is you're going to stop trading our wild turkeys.
Yeah. Well, you don't have rattlesnakes up here.
Any questions for Mr. Stryker? Yes, Senator Bishop.
Just a comment. I've floated the New River, and I was told that that's the second oldest river in the world.
They can't say that definitively, but yes, it probably is. When they were referring to it as being new, it wasn't new chronologically. If you think about the age of that river, right, the Appalachian Mountains are actually much, much older than the Rocky Mountains. That river was there before the canyon even and used to flow north. It actually is an ancient river. Thank you for the natural resources point of interest.
Park Service can't resist, right?
And Ms. Hart, you're going to stay up?
I'll stay here, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Next, we have Michelle Stevens here to talk about trail economics.
Hello. I'd like to say thank you for staying late and listening to us. My name is Michelle Stevens, and I'm president of Petersville Community Nonprofit at Petersville, Alaska, near South Denali. I am also ambassador to the Alaska Outdoor Alliance. I would like to talk about the SnowTrack program, but first I will give you a little history. The Snowmobile Trails Advisory Council, known as SnowTrack, was established under Title 41 in 1997 through the offices of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, with the mission to fairly represent all Alaskans by advising the Division of Parks on snowmobile issues, including funding, safety, registration, education, access, trail grooming, marking, development, and maintenance. The snow track program was intended to support the local communities in the winter economy. Alaska statutes authorizes the Division of Motor Vehicles to collect snowmobile and off-highway vehicle registration fees. The statute does not state what the fees will go towards. However, since inception, the promise and understanding that was DMV would transfer all fees generated to the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. The intent was once the funds were received from DMV, Division of Parks would establish a state snowmobile advisory board for Snowtrack, and that the funds received from DMV would be spent on trail grooming as well as snowmobile education and safety projects. I would like to clarify, the Snowtrack program is funded through a self-imposed user tax or snowmobile registration fee. The program is self-sustaining due to the reoccurring registration fees collected from DMV at the point of sale, registration fees collected by snow machine dealers at the time of purchase, and re-registering your snow machine. It is a revenue-neutral program that users ask for and fund out of their own registration dollars. 12% of the funds cover the cost of state park employees administering the program and administrative cost. At the time the Snowtrack program was put into play, snow machiners were proliferating for recreation, transportation, and subsistence use. There were very few marked trails or maintained trails. Oops. The consequences were high accident rates, lost snow machiners, which is a cost to the state of Alaska. Winter conflicts among trail users and conflicts with private property owners. The Snowtrack program has been a success. Can I see that napkin, please? My nose is dripping. Sorry. Yeah, I know, right? Okay, the Snowtrack program has been a success. It took many years of brushing and cutting trails, surveying and mapping out trails. The communities who have received Snowtrack funding have succeeded in achieving all goals the Snowtrack program intended it to be. People are getting to their remote cabin safe. They are buying and hauling fuel supplies. More land is being purchased and cabins are being built because of the ease and safety of the trail system being marked and groomed. Remote businesses are flourishing. They are building, hauling fuel and supplies, all due to the Snowtrack program. During the past 7 years, the Snowtrack program has been in decline in funding for several reasons, mainly lack of enforcement of registration, so people are not re-registering their snow machines, partly because they don't understand the benefits and partly because they don't trust the governor who will keep the program alive. Since the Walker administration, snow machine clubs, businesses, and nonprofits have had to fight for the fees to be reinstated to the Snowtrack program and not be included in the general fund. Due to registration fees being only $5 a year and to the lack of enforcement on the trails, the Snowtrack program is quickly becoming a program of the past. Our funding has dropped from $250,000 per year to $150,000 this year. Over the past year, snow machine clubs, businesses, and nonprofits have strived for an increase in registration fees. This legislation we hope to succeed with House Bill 23 to continue with the Snowtrack program. Representative Mark Newman has introduced HB 23, which increases our registration fees from $5 a year to $10 a year. Snowmobilers spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in our winter economy, which otherwise would be slow. Winter tourism is on the rise because of the groomed trails, which provide responsible riding, safety, and winter highways. On average, a single snow machiner spends $50,000 in a season. For example, the snow machine costs roughly $12,000. A truck costs $30,000. A trailer, and you just go on down the line. The economic outcome. A study done by Earth Economics in 2015 found that for every dollar spent in open public space in the Matsu borough, there is a $5.31 return on that investment. The groomed trails have helped considerably in keeping the cost of the state of Alaska's search and rescue to a minimal. With signs, maps, and groomed trails, riders are less likely to get lost. This means the troopers are called out less, so the cost of state of Alaska is less. I've been involved in SAR since 1989. Since the groomed trails have been introduced, Petersville Search and Rescue has had less rescues to respond to. The groomed trails are critical to first responders. They allow expedient access to the backcountry, thus helping the victims sooner and less likely to suffer loss of life or limb, and allow ease of transporting victims with broken limbs. The SnowTrack program benefits all Alaskans and anyone who wants to enjoy all that Alaska has to offer in the winter. SnowTrack saves lives, promotes safety, stimulates the economy, and creates jobs. If the SnowTrack program does not continue, it will devastate businesses, clubs, and outdoor activities in all of South Central Alaska. Who will be affected? The entire Matanuska-Susitna Valley, 16 clubs, 20 businesses, 39 lodges, 15 snow machine dealers, 10 dog machine events, including the Iditarod and the Iditasport, 24 snow machine events, 3 fat tire bike events, and more than 66,000 registered snow machine owners. The SnowTrack program is a one-of-a-kind in this state and should be an example of other user groups for their service needs.
Thank you, Ms. Stevens. That was excellent. And I have to tell you, I think we talked the other day, being a owner of a winter cabin for the last 30-plus years and building it prior to there being any groomers from the Cabin Hoppers Club.
Yes.
I think I still have compression injuries from moving materials and people, rough trails all the time. I think it's a very important program, and I think we have to ensure that it remains funded the way it has been in the past, at least. I think, unfortunately, that your comments about compliance is about a different problem. That's not a consideration of mine. When the renewal comes, you pay it because that's what you're supposed to do. And I think we have less and less people that are focused on things that they're supposed to do. So I don't know that the ones that are compliant should be doubled up. We'll see what happens with the bill. I think we have to enforce the rules that we have, which is a problem. But the groups do a great job, and I'm glad that we returned the funding in the past that had been trimmed. But other questions for Ms. Stevens? Senator Bishop?
Just a comment. I don't have a big problem with the increase because our growing season has extended on both ends, and the brushing that's required to keep these trails open is increasing, so our dollars aren't going as far as they used to. And, you know, we see that in Fairbanks with our local utilities are having to outsource and get more contractors in to keep that those rights of way clear, and our DOT is seeing it. So, but I think the money needs to be applied because the user group did come forward with this self-imposed fee, and it needs to go where it is intended to go. And if it's not going to go there, then do away with the program.
I agree.
Yes, sir. Senator Cargill.
First of all, thank you for, I think, many years of hard labor on this one. Thank you very much. What you did say piqued my interest. I know that on our search and rescue issue, these trails have been very significant, and obviously, from what you're stating, it's demonstrable. You can demonstrate it. So, but in some areas of state, I think from the northeastern side of Fairbanks and over on the Richardson Highway, I don't know that that's the case. And so has this been a discussion in other snow machine events or snow machine venues?
Yes, we don't have a whole lot of northern interest, but we do have some trails. We have the Chena area has groomed trails. And there's one other one, I may be wrong, but I thought it was over there towards Chattanooga, but I'm not sure. We do know that there is a problem with everybody having to register and not everybody getting the benefits. But some of that is they can have these same benefits if they take the initiative to survey their trails. It doesn't have to be a trail that they might have a need for. The Snow Track program covers signage and other safety aspects of what a club or a person would need. We've had some people in the northern region. They applied for some of these grants off and on, and they got the grants, but it was mostly for signage or marking the trails for, because they don't have groomed trails up there.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the signage is very important, because we bump up against each other between ski touring, trapping, and snow machining, and the signage, I think, is something that we are going to have to continue working on. And so I think what you've done down in Matsu is very good, and I didn't realize that we'd already started some of that up in the Chena area, so
yes.
It's nice to know.
Just to dovetail off to Senator Coghill's comments, and the more that we can keep these trails for snow machines, the less impact we're going to have on our Fairbanks Dog Mushers trails within the Kramer's Field.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, so.
So it looks like we got work to do.
May I speak to that? We do. Our trails are all multi-use, so we reach out to the dog teams and everybody, but the snow machiners pay for it, and our system is quite wide. It's from the Petersville area, and also in Denali Highway is groomed, and it goes down from Petersville to Willow to Trappa Creek to Big Lake, and then we have the Lake Louise and Eureka and Sheep Mountain Gunsight area. Those are huge trail systems, about 150 miles, and then the Caribou Hills and the Homer Snowmads have a very intricate system, and they do their trails year-round instead of just winter.
We have a lot to cover.
Okay.
But go ahead, if you, Senator Rivak, you have a quick question.
Just real quick, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned Willow is the Yentner River part of the Snow Track
trail
system. Yeah, I've spent some time out there, and I just really appreciate the work. There's a local man that grooms those trails out there, and it doesn't make the press a lot, but being out there quite a bit, I'd imagine he's saved several lives by the work he does out there, and it's a very heavily traveled trail, being on the Iditarod Trail and all that, and a lot of people live out there year-round, so it definitely has been a benefit to the communities between Willow and Squintna.
Yes, they have several lodges out there, that, like the Squintna Roadhouse, Rebel's Roost. There's several of them out there. Without this trail system, they'd be closed in the winter.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Michelle, for being here. Next we have Mr. Beck, Chris Beck, with the Alaska Statewide Trails Initiative.
Thank you. I'm sure this time of day, at the end of a long day, that you're looking forward to the really fully fleshed out 50-minute version here with, that's supposed to be humor. I'll see if we can get through this quickly. So, yes, Chris Beck is my name.
If I can, we're very interested. I don't want to cut anyone short. You have a couple more, four more presenters, and we want to give everyone adequate time and then maybe have time for questions at the end. So that's the only reason I'm sort of.
Well, I appreciate your interest. And I claim I'm going to be brief, and then you'll see Lee hitting me with her elbow and showing me that I had not achieved that goal. I'm already going on. So do you have something in your...
Yep.
Material looks like this. So I'll start off with the basic starting point, which is, I think, something most people would agree. We have amazing outdoor recreation resources in our state, and we've never really taken a thoughtful effort to really try to take most advantage of those in terms of the investments we make in infrastructure and how we maintain that infrastructure, how we really plan for it, how we think about, how to, for example, using what you were just talking about, how to maybe combine or split out dog mushing and snow machines, or how you generally just take full advantage of our opportunities. So through this Trails Initiative, working with Lee, we are really trying to address those opportunities. And Lee's shared a few of the benefits. The one I like to bring up, because to me it's so striking, is if you look at the amount of spending that existing out-of-state visitors are doing when they come to Alaska, They spend on average 9 days. If we could get them, half of them, to spend one more day, it's $137 million of additional spending. You know, in Alaska, 9 days, New Zealand, which is a destination in many ways similar to Alaska, it's a long plane flight to get there. That's 19 days is the average stay. So if we could push from 9 days to 11 or 12, we're talking a quarter of a billion, half a billion dollars of money. In many ways, I believe we're leaving on the table through not having made the kind of investments that our competing destinations are making in trails, in trailheads, in boat launches, and all the things that you might do to give people a reason to have that one more day. So that's the opportunity and some of the benefits. So the obvious question, how are we trying to address that? What might we do? The backside of that handout shows one part of the state, and we're really trying to make a more systematic and more comprehensive look at how we invest. So there's a corridor that runs from Seward up to Fairbanks, calling the Seward-Fairbanks Adventure Corridor, and part of what drives that is that is a major area of population in the state. There is getting ready to be most likely a very substantial investment in a new port facility in Seward. The Alaska Railroad is partnering with ADA and they've received a series of offers for $100 to $150 million investment in building a new cruise ship terminal that would have much greater capacity than one today. So we're already seeing around 400,000 visitors coming across the Gulf going to Seward. That's likely to increase. And so what we're proposing is, what are some ways we might get people to spend that extra day or those extra 2 days? So this is a series of projects that are summarized on this sheet. This is really a summary. Those are coming in each location, not just from one or two people or from me. So in Fairbanks, we met a couple weeks ago and met with the borough, with the Economic Development Organization, with Deb Hickok there at the tourism organization, and then a number of trail user groups, a number of individual businesses, and came up with a set of ideas. The one that's furthest down the line to me is something I'm particularly excited about, which is using a working landscape, in this case Tanana State Forest, where there are already some old and deteriorating timber roads. It looks like we're going to find $100,000 to go in and fix up some of those roads that were otherwise going to not do anything but deteriorate for the next 20 years because there wasn't any more timber harvest planned. And so there'll be money to fix this up and add some trails. Continuing down the highway, some of the other projects, we're working in the Denali Borough where there's an attempt to do some work to expand some front country opportunities because, as Don would quickly attest, we can't endlessly send more and more people up the Denali Park Road. There's just some limit of how many folks can go there and keep the wildlife viewing opportunity strong. But people would like to spend time in the front country if there's things to do. You can go for an ATV tour, you can go for a horseback ride, you can hang out, go for a hike. So we're working with the borough on some projects there. Continuing down the road, we're working in the South Denali area, in the Hatcher Pass area with the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. In Anchorage, we're trying to get new front doors into the Chugach State Park. And then down into Chugach National Forest, working with the National Forest there to try to fill in some of the gaps in the Iditarod Trail, where there are a series of bridges that are missing, and the absence of which means you got a gap in an otherwise what would be a through trail, potentially from Seward all the way to Girdwood, and would be something that could be known worldwide. So those are examples of the kinds of projects. Yes. The obvious issue, where do the funds come to build those and how to do that? And I sort of two categories of response, and that in some ways is an ask back to you folks. I guess it's not even in some ways, it is. I kind of feel like Alaska has been sort of increasingly stuck in what I would call like a poverty mentality. I would like that to evolve into an investment mentality. And that's, I can't snap fingers and make that happen. But the absence of investment means we are leaving those billions of dollars on the table. And so how do we find those funds? One of the ways is pretty straightforward. The federal government is trying to bring money to Alaska that we've chosen as a state to not take. Land Water Conservation Fund, $2 million sitting on our doorstep. Last year, receipt authority for those funds was not established. And so we don't have access to those funds. That still requires a 50% match.
Sorry, sir, what was the?
Land Water Conservation Fund. It's the federal dollars set up to come from offshore oil and gas drilling. And another example, which the legislature weighed in on in a way we've greatly appreciated, is the Pittman-Robertson funds, the money that's generated from the sales of guns and ammunition. But Department of Fish and Game, I don't want to throw them under the bus, but they were returning millions of dollars every year that they just didn't have quite the administrative capacity to take advantage of. So last year there was a resolution passed that says henceforth $2 million at least of those funds will be available for the first time to third parties who can submit an application to get access to those funds. So there's pipelines of federal money we're not taking. That's one example of a switch to an investment mentality. Let's take advantage of the money that is there. There's also coming up, we hope, a national infrastructure bill. So having projects like these shovel ready, so the moment that bill hits the table, we can be at the front of the line saying, here are projects that are shovel ready, bring a lot of benefits. And then another one we'd ask you to at least to begin to consider is some way to begin to have a capital budget. And in lieu of that, perhaps considering general obligation bonds. Those have happened in Alaska in the past. And again, it requires thinking more of an investment mentality, but that's a way to borrow money into the future. And so those are some examples. We would look forward to working with you folks. Wrapping up by just saying there's sure a lot of opportunities. Our economy is growing in this area, not in many other areas, and it seems like a chance to have our kids have reasons to come back and live in Alaska, and it's good for communities, and it's a way to keep the things that are best about Alaska going and make money from that.
Mr. Beck, I will tell you one thing that I've noticed is a gap in Alaska, and I've been to some northern cities that have fairly large populations like Duluth, Minnesota, that have snow machine trails through the middle of the city.
Yeah.
We've potentially already missed the boat on some very basic infrastructure that would encourage a lot more activity in the little town of Soldotna, Alaska. You have to load your machines on a trailer, go 4 miles and unload them, which makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, we're still an infant state. Is that something we're planning on corridors?
It's a great example of the kind of thing we could do a better job of. The summer examples, nobody loves hearing about examples from Oregon, you know, kind of a socialist state down there, but that's also an attempted humor. But Bend, Oregon went from it being a dying timber town to a phenomenally successful multi-season recreation destination because the trails that are on the outskirts of town come into town. And you can stay at an Airbnb and be in a nice little place and have a brew pub across the street, but you can get on your bike and end up in these beautiful bike trail systems. So destination town is sort of defined as a place that's a fun place to be, and it's really easy to get from that location to the outdoor recreation in the surrounding area, doing it year-round, doing it with snow machines in Talkeetna, in Soldotna, name a city, would be a huge thing to do. And we just not, as a state or as communities, really maybe been forced to think as thoughtfully about how we take advantage of our recreation resources as we could do going forward.
Yeah, I think there's sort of an evolution. I mean, we carved these places out of the woods 40, 50 years ago, and we were kind of proud to have the woods, like, not in our way anymore, and forgot about the value of having a corridor from one set of woods to the other, right? I mean, it's a big gap, but if we don't deal with that now, we will eventually permanently lose the opportunity to do
it. It's always hard now. It just gets harder later.
Senator Bishop? No question? Okay. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we have Diana Rhodes with the Anchorage Parks Foundation.
Good evening. I'm Diana Rhodes with the Anchorage Park Foundation. We are the nonprofit partner to the Municipality of Anchorage Parks and Recreation. So we formed about 15 years ago, recognizing that parks and trails need private funding sources, opportunities to complement the federal, state, and local resources. And we've been doing that for 15 years now. But we've benefited greatly from appropriations from the state legislature over time to help develop our natural resources in Anchorage. We miss those capital budget appropriations, and we want to encourage you. I've got an example. When we were formed, the Anchorage Park Foundation became the advocacy for the municipality's park bonds. So the municipality does offer park bonds every year, so that gives us a way to look at the at what people are thinking about these investments in parks and trails. And when we first started, you know, people weren't supporting them. People weren't supporting the park bonds. But over time, 10 of the last 13 park bonds have passed, and 8 years in a row in Anchorage, Anchorage voters have supported park bonds to just help you make you feel more comfortable if you were to offer a general obligation bond for these kinds of projects that fill those gaps in outdoor recreation infrastructure, transportation infrastructure. There is a willing voters to help pay for those kinds of programs. I understand that the GO bonds, the last one was in 2012 from the state level, and it had an associated advisory vote in the state, and that vote was 65-35 for a passage, as I understand it. But that was 2012, a long time ago, and it might be time. Might be time to consider that for the future. The other way that we advocate for increased infrastructure investment is through federal transportation dollars. The FAST Act is the current authorization bill right now. It sunsets in September of this year. So now is the time to advocate for more federal dollars through two main programs. The RTP program is the Recreational Trails Program. That's the federal funding that comes to the State Department of Parks and Recreation, and then they offer grants to local communities to match them. So our organization is an example of one organization across the state that does help provide those matching funds to get those investments to our state. The other program is the Active Transportation Program, and that was a program that started under Don Young, under his bill, under the Safety Lou transportation bill that he authored, and that program was so successful that it has continued on. Again, it's also passes through the State Department of Transportation and in Anchorage through AMATS, and it provides a way to build this important, you know, multi-use trails. In Anchorage, we have this exciting project that is taking those investments in our multi-use trails along the Tony Knowles Coastal Trail, Chester Creek Trail, Ship Creek Trail, and Campbell Creek Trail. We just looked at it on a map last summer and realized that it looks like a moose. And so if we get this one little $13 million bridge, we can do these huge events, and we can make this be a destination trail for Anchorage. And as Chris Beck likes to say, you know, if we had one more day, if people would stay one more day in any one of our communities, it would leverage $137 million to our local economy. So our GAP project in Anchorage is this moose loop that we need a bridge. But all across the state, there are other tiny little projects that need this investment. So just encourage you to think about this for the future. Developing our outdoor recreation economy will take some investment, but it leverages a lot in the long term. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Rhodes? Thank you very much. That brings us to Jen. Lehi?
Leahy.
Like
Senator Leahy.
Leahy. Thank you for being here. Please proceed.
Thank you so much for having us this evening. Appreciate all of your time, and I'll try and be brief so we have room for Teresa. I'm Jen Leahy. I'm based in Seward on the beautiful Kenai Peninsula, and I'm here working on behalf of hunters and anglers across our state as the Alaska Field Representative for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. This is a new role that I'd be happy to talk offline with any of you about. We focus on federal policy, that helps safeguard access to public land, ensures healthy wildlife habitat and clean water, and advocates for adequate funding for conservation programs. And those are things that don't just benefit hunters and anglers, they benefit our entire outdoor recreation and tourism industries. By investing in my role and having a year-round presence in the state, TRCP is growing our capacity to support more federal land management efforts here in Alaska, so that's what I focus my time on. Wildlife is the heart of not just our cultural heritage, also our global brand. It provides us with recreation opportunities, nourishing food, and it helps fuel our economy, both residents and visitors alike, the interactions that they have with wildlife. ADF&G commissioned a study several years ago that helped determine the economic importance of wildlife for our state, and I just want to share two quick highlights. Residents and visitors spent $3.4 billion on activities related to hunting and wildlife viewing. We're not even talking about fishing in the mix here. That in turn generated a $4.1 billion economic return throughout the state, which was 8% of our overall output. 28,000 jobs, $1.4 billion in labor income, $340 million in government revenue. And then when we look at fishing and the resident, the recreational, personal use, and subsistence sectors, we're looking at another $200 million annually that's generated here in the state. So all of this economic activity is dependent on continued public access to healthy wildlife habitat and our fisheries, which is why conservation funding is so important. And I love that I get to come and talk with you about something that, you know, we're my sector isn't doesn't have a particular ask around funding because we pay our own way. Hunters and anglers fund conservation through excise taxes and license purchases. It's a user pay, user benefit model. One of the most important things we can do, as Chris mentioned, was to take advantage of federal funds that support wildlife and fish restoration. Alaska receives more money through Pittman-Robertson and the Dingell-Johnson Acts for those activities than any other state besides Texas. And they pay for things like hunter education programs, special projects in our refuges, wildlife health and disease surveillance, fish cleaning tables. In order for ADF&G to receive those funds, the state needs to contribute a 25% match, which is typically covered through the purchase of hunting and fishing licenses. Last year, hunters and anglers spent more than $30 million in license fees in Alaska, so we've got a pretty good thing going. Last year, the governor vetoed $300,000 that was allocated as part of the state's match for Pittman-Robertson, and thankfully it was reallocated by the legislature. Thank you for those of you who worked on that. So I'd like to, in summary, just leave you with three ideas. The idea that programs that support healthy wildlife and fisheries are important to our entire outdoor sector and tourism industry, not just sportsmen, that hunters and anglers pay our own way, and let's not leave federal money on the table. And whatever we can do to be helpful in those regards, be happy to connect more. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Questions for Jen? I just advice when you said, unlike the others, you pay your own way, they gave this funny look behind you. <so. laughs>
Sorry, not my friends in this world. More resource extractive industries maybe need a little more help than our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. That was a joke, like Mr. Becks. Next, we have Teresa Whipple. South Central Bear Viewing Economy is the topic.
Indeed. Good evening. Again, thank you for taking the time. My name is Teresa Whipple, and yes, I'm here representing the economic significance of commercial bear viewing, specifically in South Central Alaska. So, and that is because I'm a bear viewing guide. And so bears take up my entire year. For 8 months out of the year, I'm taking people to see them in the wild, and then for the 4 months out of the year where they can't be viewed, I am educating people about them through my own bear company. So they are my life, they're my passion, black, brown, and white, and they are also my entire annual income, which the reason we have such good commercial bear viewing in the state is because we have such amazing good bear habitat. And I think it's no coincidence that in all of the artwork on this room, there's a bear right up there on the wall, because Bears are iconic for the Alaskan wilderness, and they're that way because of the good bear habitat, especially the areas in Katmai, Lake Clark, the shorelines of Bristol Bay, Western Cook Inlet, even in the Tongass Islands that we have here. And as we see competing uses for natural resources in these natural environments, in these good habitats, I think it's critical to consider the importance of the commercial bear viewing as an outdoor recreation activity. So in South Central alone, in 2017, including the areas of Katmai, Lake Clark, and McNeil River, commercial bear viewing operations reported over $34 million in sales. And that probably shouldn't be a surprise either, because when polled, over 70% of visitors who come to Alaska come with the intention and the goal of viewing or photographing a wild bear. So I don't want to get funny looks from behind me either. We're a thriving industry, we're a growing industry, and we need protection and conservation and preserving good bear habitat. So it's just simply a pleasure to be here this week with Lee and this group of people as part of the Outdoor Alliance.
Yeah, Senator Reback, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious about your customers. Are they typically folks who come specifically to view bears, or are they, or are most of them folks who come here for vacations and then do a bear viewing trip, or is there any kind of trend?
So the companies that I work for across the state, I would say the trend for those group of people are specifically going on a trip to see a bear specifically. Generally speaking, they're coupled with going to visit Denali Park, and then they go on a bear trip specific after that. Or they're doing a trip to Glacier Bay, and then they do a bear trip specific after that. And that's the kind of clientele that the companies that I work for specifically cater to. But you can't, you know, I can't tell you how many times with talking with visitors here, they don't go on a bear specific trip. And when they hear I'm a bear guide, they say, you know, I haven't seen a bear yet. Can you tell me where I can go see one? Because I really wanted to see a bear when I came to Alaska. So some sort of just assume that they're on every corner and that they'll see one while they're here. And then others want to make sure that they don't miss the chance to see one and take a bear specific trip. And in fact, in 2017, when this report was specifically done, they found that for the first time, commercial bear viewing had surpassed sales of sport fishing, which historically had always been Alaska's number one outdoor rec moneymaker.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, thank you for making it a business, because most of us who see a bear without this kind of business are not safe. But it was interesting to me, on two different occasions now, I have run into people who I think watch the Katmai bears on TV. They have a program that they watch them. They have it on their screensaver. Mm-hmm. It was quite interesting. One in Minneapolis and one in Fairbanks. It's amazing to me. So I think you are getting some good viewing that way as well.
Indeed, yes. There's the Brooks Falls cam, which is getting more and more and more millions of viewers per year. And they're even doing fun things with cameras for polar bears now up in the north.
So in all of the things that we're talking about, there are these natural conflicts. And I personally don't know if, you know, they say that certain animals can sense fear. My experience with bears is, for some reason, they can sense when I'm in my skivvies.
Okay.
I'll tell you about those three or four experiences offline. But we have a lot of conflict in my neck of the woods. We have had long-standing companies that very safely have operated bear viewing opportunities. And because of the growth, we have a lot of newcomers that are not as conscientious. Flying times, low ceilings, crowding, not only wildlife, but other operators. How do we put that all in the mix? There is one, and I'm going to call out the area, but there's an area, it's become dangerous. How do we work those conflicts out so that we can have the growth of an industry but the newcomers learn how to operate responsibly?
Well, not that this is particularly part of the paperwork that I have in front of me, but the company that I own is called Ursa Major Training and Consulting, and in fact, we need companies like mine and others like it to, in fact, have a standardization for being a bear guide. So that's something that there are several bear organizations across the state are working towards, and that would be something that maybe is coming in the future as a presentation right here in front of you. Because of now, to be a bear viewing guide in the state of Alaska, all you have to say is, I'm a bear viewing guide, and that's it. We don't have a program or certification, a training. We have nothing that states that these people who are going in and maybe overcrowding these places, but maybe just don't have as much experience or knowledge. We don't have a standard program, and that is something that in the background is coming as well.
So when you think about, and I don't want to overregulate anyone, there's a balance, right? But when you think about what a guide or a master guide has to go through, and then you compare that to some of the situations we're seeing now, we need to further develop expectations for wildlife guides.
Yes, that is a project, and not to name names, but there were certain issues that the bear viewing community has decided that are a little bit more important to take care of on a more immediate basis. And once we have a certain kind of promotion and protection of good bear habitat, then we can continue moving forward with this standard training for a bear guide.
That's good news. I have some folks that are very worried about not only the folks that are hiring a bear guide to fly them in somewhere have no idea what safety looks like. They're for the first time from somewhere else on a small plane landing on the beach in the middle of nowhere where there are bears.
Yes.
And they don't know that someone is operating unsafely, right? I mean, they're somewhere between bear bait or going to be lost with a low ceiling problem crossing Cook Inlet. I mean, there are all kinds of things that could happen, and there's...
So historically, these bear viewing areas are generally regulated by Fish and Game Forest Service or the national parks or any combination of relationships of those particular governing agencies. And in places where we don't have official status as commercial bear viewing, but that people are doing it there anyway, because you can find bears on a lot of corners of these places, that there's no one particular body that wants to take the responsibility for educating or regulating the areas that are a little bit kind of wild, wild west still. So that is how the project of making a standard bear training came about, but that's been done by private and nonprofit organizations.
Thank you very much, Ms. Whipple. Do you have another question?
Yes. For Lee and for the whole crowd. Thank you, first of all, thank you. I know this it's a labor of love, and it's an expensive labor, so I get all that. But so being born and raised here, there's a balance. We came out of kind of a survival mode plus a wonder mode. We were just in wonder about the state, you know. And so what we're doing now is we're beginning to try to organize ourselves. But there is something Anchorage has dealt with it now, and that is, you make it accessible, but some people don't understand that you got to be aware of a moose, for example. And so there has to be somehow an awareness that comes along with the use of a snow machine trail. You know, you can be these snow machines can go 100 miles an hour, 80 miles an hour, and you could run over a kid without even knowing it. I mean there's those things that we need to think about now that we're talking about a more organized approach to it. I appreciate the effort, believe me, I do. And 100 years ago, a trapping line was not a multi-use line, but many of us did. And but it was you were trespassing really on somebody else's line use. Now we're starting to say, let's open it up for a further discussion. And so awareness as we go along, So as we begin, if we look for more public funding, that awareness kind of has to go with it. Mm-hmm. And for one, I think you're right. If we're going to attract people to Alaska, there's a lot of things that are going to be high value, but they also come with liability. And that's why I was asking about the SARs, for example. We put people in a situation where if they don't have a guide and they dial 911, they may not get anybody. You know, yeah, they may. I know there's some places where you can do text, but you can't really. So those kind of things, as we're thinking about these adventures, and it really is truly how to enjoy the adventure of Alaska. As we look at it, we also look at our telecom, our safety net for responses and things like that. And for guiding, I think you have to take all that into consideration. There's no doubt about it. But we're opening it up as an open use. And once again, as the bear thing, they are not pets. And there are many other issues. You know, a moose is not something to be trifled with at all. And so this is something I just wanted to say it out loud. Thank you for your work, because I know as we go, that's going to be part of the discussion. And as we try to find funding, it's the question that goes with the funding, just to let you know.
Yeah.
Other comments? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, to Senator Coghill's comment about safety, I'm still trying to get over the mental picture you drew for us all. But to the issue we
that was my wife.
to the issue we were talking about, I would be interested in how those conversations develop about standards and about sort of what constitutes bear guiding, where we need those standards. You know, I think about probably a dozen miles from here, you've got an area that with almost 500,000 folks come through it on buses and walking overpasses with a wild bear under your feet. Certainly Mr. Stryker's federal partners in the green outfits keep an eye out, but they're not guiding folks. How do we draw those sort of distinctions so that, you know, the folks who are going out to Pack Creek are one thing, but you know, you don't necessarily need guides when you're going out to Steep Creek.
That is potentially arguable that you might need a guide going out to Steep Creek, but the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center has had a very unique and sharp learning curve for how they manage bear-human interactions at the visitor center. And I don't know if you're familiar with, but during the winter time, they put on a series of what they call fireside chats on Friday nights, and two Fridays ago, there was a presentation done on a bear called Nikki, and Nikki is a black bear that lives in this area and has for her entire life. She was a cub born here. She's now raising her own cubs here. And under the direction of John Neary, who's just recently retired from being the director of the center, who used to be a bear biologist, his time at the center, not only did he help shape the viewing protocols for what happens at Pack Creek, he was instrumental in helping the changes of how bears are managed at the center. And in this particular case, because you have to take every area by specific case, you're talking about large numbers of people coming into bear habitat, and so what they are doing is managing people, not bears. And that is a different approach. In this particular case, when you hire a guide to go to Pack Creek, Pack Creek guides tell the people how to behave, but generally speaking, they're managing the bear around the person. So very different tactics, and certainly worth analyzing. And the guys in the green uniforms there are doing an absolutely fantastic job with that bear-human interaction. And it all is all based around this particular bear that they call Nikki, that they've tagged her, they've tracked her, they put GPS markers on her. And as they have learned more about the bear movements in that area, they've come to learn how better manage the people around the habitat that the bears use. And they've got it down to quite the art at this point. And so the presentation was about this bear's life and how they've, what they've learned from her, how they manage people around bear habitat at the center now.
Thank you all so very much. We're getting a little bit into the weeds, which legislators never do. So, and I'm equally guilty. I think the reason you're here is we barely scratched the surface of an outdoor economy in the state of Alaska. I think we all know that. When the rest of the state was floundering in a self-imposed recession, we watched tourism just firing on all cylinders and kind of making us proud in those areas that have an income, revenue stream from tourism. So we're interested in learning more. Anything you get to us, we'll read. We'd like to support you. The shoulder season idea, other than breakup, where we need a break probably, there are amazing things that happen all year long that we're not taking advantage of. So bring us your ideas and let us know how we can support you, and thanks for being here so very much.
Chairman, may I make a closing comment, a very brief one?
Very brief one, yes.
Very brief. So I wanted to say you've heard the breadth of what we've brought to you today, and one of the things we want to close with is encouraging you to balance the budget, wrangle that big beast, and get fiscal policies and practices that are sustainable so that we can move beyond your time being dominated by those conversations and on to these types of topics and how we make Alaska shine as the world-class destination that it deserves to be renowned for. We also believe in please tackle the ferry question, in addition to being a lifeblood for Southeast. There's communities within Southeast that don't want to be part of the big cruise industry and depend on the ferry to bring them independent travelers. Without that, those guests coming to their communities, they lose out again. We have on the second sheet of my slides, the Unsung Economic Powerhouse lists some of our asks. You've already, I believe, you've considered White House Joint Resolution 25 for the Denali Park Road, and that passed? That was Monday, I think.
We moved it out of this committee.
Yeah, thank you.
It's ready for the floor, actually.
Thank you. So we want to thank you for that. We want to say that as you recognize the value of that asset, let's also recognize our own. So when you get to that point where we have the budget under control, that we're catching up on a $60 million deferred maintenance budget in our state parks, and that we begin to budget for capital improvements there that can help those assets shine and work harder for us and for our economies and gateway communities. As a couple of my colleagues said, please don't leave money on the table. There's over $50 million of federal funding that we can tap into we have receipt authority and we have the matching funds available for it. Support our user-funded programs like SnowTrack. Help us get to next-level research that can help us give you the tools you need to make good decisions. And then also, again, expand your definition of what resource development needs so that when we talk about maximum use consistent with the public interest, it's also considering outdoor recreation in that equation. And then in infrastructure, and I think we talked about this, about the snow, the roads and, you know, travel between town and the trails in Soldotna, talk about our outdoor recreation is transportation infrastructure as well. And so there's opportunities for us. We would love to work with you on bills to address that issue and some others. And so hopefully in coming sessions, we'll be able to bring forward some things that, again, remove those barriers and obstacles to this industry growing. And I want to say that every time you have a chance to make a decision that affects our sector, vote the outdoors.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for being here. I want to thank Nate, our LIO moderator, Chris Dickrell with Senate Records, and Conrad Jackson with my staff for being here today. As there is no further business to come before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 6:21:33 p.m.